the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the ExchangeWire MadTech Podcast. I'm your host this week, Anne-Marie Sheedy, Director of Global Partnerships at ExchangeWire, and I am delighted to be joined by Liz Salway from Publicis' in-house digital transformation team on a secondment with Nestle. Great to have a fellow Limerick lady on the podcast, which we've just discovered on this special day. But of course, I'm also privileged to be joined by my esteemed colleague, Lindsay Rowntree. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, from the token English person in the room.
Oh, never mind. It could be worse.
Oh, well.
Some of our other Irish colleagues could be in the office today.
This is very true. It's nice to have just two of you. Otherwise, I think I'd be drowning in paddiness.
How rude.
Well, you know, have to say it how it is or how it would be. Thankfully, one of the Cheltenhams, that makes things much quieter.
Yes, only in person, because I'm sure we'll be getting telegrams through all the time about, you know, win, lose or draw.
Certainly.
But I hope he and the lads are having a great time. Right, let's crack on. So we'll kick off with the first story, which is about digital native vertical brands, otherwise known as DNVBs. So they're companies that typically began their online operative via direct consumer model. And more often than not, failing to turn a profit, even in cases where they're generating high revenue and sales rates. Now, despite rapid growth, many who have gone public are still burning through capital and seeing losses expand. Some have established themselves as real market disruptors and could stand to become sustainable in the future, but questions remain over whether every DNVB has a realistic understanding of the market they're trying to break. And with that comes the question around, you know, the economic viability of their business model. This article is coming from a guy called Steve Dennis from Forbes, and he's pointed out that it's a lot harder now for brands to accrue customers, positive customer lifetime value, CLV, we love an acronym in this business, due to price hikes in digital marketing and tighter privacy regulations. However, the success of this strategy is yet unproven. If you think of Warby Parker, who IPO'd in September, have opened 160 stores, but have seen losses increase. So, with this in mind, Lindsay, I'm going to come to you first, and I'd like you to kind of help us understand, how disruptive do you believe that the emergence of DNVBs has been to retail, and can you think of any who have turned a profit since going public?
So, I'll have to call them DTCs, because DNVBs will just become too much of a mouthful very, very quickly. But DNVBs are effectively what we'd also call DTCs, direct-to-consumer companies. So these are companies that obviously have disintermediated, if you like, the retailer, the physical or commerce retailer, and gone directly to the consumer themselves. And they have been hugely disruptive over the past few years. And we've had some fantastic stories of, you know, the examples you gave, Anne-Marie, like Warby Parker. And I remember when they went public back in September, and Scott Galloway, Press Scott Galloway, obviously old grumpy curmudgeon that he is, but also kind of very much on the money, was talking about them, the Swiss shoe company called On, Allbirds, also a shoe company, and then Rent the Runway, them all kind of IPOing around the similar time, and looking at all their S1 filings and what they were all talking about, and how there was some creative accounting being used to show how profitable they were or how profitable they could be. And actually, the challenge you're still finding with these companies, the Warby Parker, actually, of those four at a time, was the best bet. Well, it really isn't now. And I think that there's obviously, we've had pandemic challenges. It's very hard to understand how a consumer is going to react at the moment, because, you know, we've not got real kind of trends to be able to look at, because the past 2 years have been such a weird time for consumers in terms of how what their purchasing habits are, etc. So that, you know, they've opened up a lot of physical stores. But I think that most DTC start out e-commerce, realize fairly quick, they do really, really well in terms of get loads of revenue in, but that revenue isn't profitable, because it's revenue at all costs is what it seems like at the moment. And then they decide that we need to go further than this. Let's do a couple of pop-ups. Let's open up a physical store. But of course, stores can't scale like e-commerce can. So the challenge they then have is to try to get enough revenue from the store to make the stores viable, make them worthwhile. But the cost of running a store is far greater than the cost of running an e-commerce site, which means they have to increase their prices, can that work for them to stay, like, will they be able to sustain that price elevation? They normally keep the prices the same and kind of going at a loss leader. But of course, that then affects them and they lose even more profit and their profit margin gets even worse and they're even more in the red. But I think that, and then you then see them partner with retailers. The one thing a lot of these brands swear they'll never do is partner with retailers. You know, I remember when I first saw Harry's on a Boots shelf. I was very surprised to see that because they were always, you know, dead set on being a subscription service that we are an amazing direct-to-consumer company. We now work with retailers, something that's very, very challenging. But I think DTCs have made many brands, you know, people like Nike, Adidas, that have really grown their digital, direct consumer offering in the past few years, made them realise, actually, we can have a relationship with our consumers directly. And actually, there's a lot of benefit to that. Working with retailers can be challenging because retailers don't necessarily give you a lot of information about what your customer looks like, what sales figures look like, you give them money, kind of used to be called co-op budget. Well, I'm sure we'll get into the whole retail media space shortly, but that co-op budget used to be given to a retailer and the brand would not really have any idea what was done with it. They would just, it's being used for marketing. Well, what kind of marketing? How can I understand what marketing you've used it for and how will that affect my bottom line? And how do I understand what customers? And actually me having that customer data means that I can iterate my products better. I can understand who my customers are and build better products for them. So I think that disruption has really helped kind of a lot of the more bigger legacy brands really kind of hone their DTC offerings, understand how they can, I guess, have a hybrid model. But what it is proving is that a DTC only model probably isn't the solution, and nor is a sub only model. I remember we had Ted Charalambidis from Pact Coffee on our defunct TTC podcast a couple of years ago, talking about the fact that, you know, Pact Coffee, which for those that aren't in the UK is a coffee subscription service, kind of lovely coffee based in London, they realised fairly quickly that their whole model was around subscription and getting recurring revenue. Of course, a really, really important aspect of any business to get recurring revenue, but they realised they've maxed that out and they now have to go down other routes and try and sell accessories to coffee and try and get people to buy one-off coffee, so as a gift and that kind of thing. And that's another thing that a lot of these DTCs that started with submodels realized we had to diversify and be able to allow customers to buy just one product from us and not have a regular subscription with us. Because the other challenge Rent the Runway have, for example, is that they say, oh, we have all these subscribers. Well, actually, how many of those subscribers are actually spending money with you? How many of them are lapsed or paused? And that's another problem that a lot of these companies have. And that points back to creative accounting a lot of them use when they IPO. But I've rambled on, but I find it fascinating. I think that it's so disruptive and has really helped the industry kind of like realize kind of like what legacy issues there are. And it's really helped accelerate digital transformation. But they've also realized a lot of the legacy practices actually will help them too. So I think there's kind of a leveling out a bit.
Crikey, that was a lot. Thank you.
I do apologise. I got into it there.
It's great. And it's really interesting. I'm curious to know, Liz, what's your perspective here?
Yeah, because I mean, when you think about it, you wonder what they're doing wrong, right? Because they're avoiding all of the cost of like substantial bricks and mortar investment, right? And all that goes with that. And then in addition, as you said, Lindsay, they've got all of that first party data from being D2C. So they can really understand what's selling and kind of be quite nimble and not have to invest in everything and then kind of see how it goes. But there's one thing in there that I think is an interesting miss potentially, and that's the job of brand building, right? And the fact that physical stores, you know, they do provide that sort of, you know, experiential thing with the brand, right? And maybe you need that to create the lifetime value from, you know, your proposition. So, you know, if you look at made.com as an example, right? So they've now started to put showrooms in place. I think there's just one in London.
Yeah,
on Tottenham Court Road, which is kind of
Cross Road around there. Yeah,
it's kind of funny, really, considering how that used to be the Furniture Road and now, or, you know, and Consumer Electronics, whatever. But
yes,
it's changed a lot. But I thought it was quite interesting to see it there because it's like, why are you doing that? What are you missing from your business model that started off, I think, quite smart, that you made to order, right? Mm-hmm. And you avoided all of those, you know, costs of heavy production and then waiting to sell en masse. So, you know, it created a sort of quite a nice supply chain concept, I think, but they're not making it work. The other one I was looking at was Wayfair. right? So in some recent financial filings, I don't know, was it last year or you know, I'm not going to say exactly whether it was 2020 or 21, but their gross margin, 30%. That's pretty healthy. But their net margin is only 2.3%. So they're doing something wrong between cost of goods sold and actually making some money. And that's interesting considering they've avoided all of the other costs. So, you know, I started to think then that, you know, what the, you know, because COVID changed everything.
Yes.
And everybody wanted to still purchase things, especially because they weren't doing anything. And if they, you know, were lucky not to be out of work, people had money burning a hole in their, you know, and they were wanting to go on holidays when it was over, and people did things with their house, etc., with Wayfair as an example. But, you know, one, now that we're back to normal, I think people do want to go and see and touch things and kind of experience stores again, which might be a reason that they're seeing, you know, a kind of a move back towards that. But yeah, I think overall the brand element is not to be kind of sneezed at. And yeah, they did some advertising, but they didn't build up any brand equity in the way that we would normally experience it, with heavy above the line, like TV. You know, they've done bits and pieces of above the line, but it's quite narrow. And I think when you look at digital, yes, the cost of you know, it's competitive in terms of search, etc., but the return on ad spend is there in that way, whereas TV is expensive and it takes time to build brand equity. So maybe that's the gap, you know, because it's very easy to fall into the trap of how you can immediately see return on investment within digital, but it takes you quite a bit longer to see that from, you know, more traditional advertising, and that brand equity stays with you for longer. So that's kind of where I think there might be something missing that they're now suffering from.
I think it's a good point, because actually a lot of these DTCs, their way of building brand has been to make somebody pay for something every month. And that's how I get my loyalty. There's a subscription in there. So that's how I'm going to keep you on my books, not put money into the above the line stuff. And actually there was, I'm going to reference Scott Galloway because it was a funny newsletter. It was the same one about Warby Parker and On Allbirds and Rent the Runway. I think it's about Rent the Runway that said that we have just adopted, or maybe it's Allbirds, a full funnel marketing approach, which I think full funnel marketing, obviously, is there's a lot more talk around this. I mean, obviously not many people use funnels anymore. They use consumer decision journeys, whatever it is they're using in terms of a marketer strategy to understand their audience and the customer lifetime value, etc. But they said, oh yeah, we're going to invest a lot of our money into full funnel marketing. And he said that's Latin for we've just raised a shit ton of cash and we're now going to invest it in TV and print. But I think that's always a joke among digital native marketers, but also digital native brands, is that why would you invest in TV and not print, maybe, but TV and kind of a lot of other above the line activity? Well, actually, for the reason you just said, there is proof that it still works. There is proof that building a brand is still fundamentally important.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of the legacy brands, because they've gone down that route, that's why they're still here today and still recognised as some of the most well-known brands and kind of top of mind awareness, net promoter scores. They do so well because of that brand building aspect, that these new brands, you know, they're reaching an audience that maybe aren't as loyal as audiences used to be, because they go where the price drop is, and that's where they've got their clients, is through constantly doing promotions and constantly trying to get people in through monetary reasons, like 20% discount if you buy now or whatever. That's why people go there, not because they're a brand. And actually, if you can't afford to do that, which these brands can't, and that's why they get bought, or that's why they end up working with Boots and other retailers, then that's the alternative, is you have to kind of go, where's our marketing budget going? Maybe it should go into TV.
Yeah, and everyone's looking for, like, you know, the quick return, or and it's catnip, right? Mm. You know, but it's, if you're going to build a brand, it's going to take time. And, you know, I definitely think that it has its role to play in more longevity for brands. So even if you think of the utility sector, right, with the brands, like the challenger brands for energy, that, you know, aside from the crisis that happened, the ones that survived longest and grew fastest were those that did TV. You know, so you can have an endless email marketing campaign, but eventually people get a bit tired of that too. So the you know, even though when you work in advertising, it's nobody really likes advertising, but you have to admit that it works.
You don't like bad advertising.
Yeah, true. I mean, there's a lot of that out there. I don't, you know,
No names, please.
On St. Patrick's Day, I think we can all agree that Guinness do fantastic, you know, brand advertising.
I will agree to that. Yeah. They definitely
do. I think they do it all year round.
Oh yeah,
personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, we've just done it now, so you know, we can get our little. You know,
anyone from Diageo?
I don't drink Guinness, but I'll happily take some free Guinness. Thank you very much.
But yeah, I mean, that stuff does matter, you know, and you're right. The creative piece is important. And I think a lot of the D2C brands have become very transactional. So there isn't really a sort of feeling of who you are as a brand. And that I think people genuinely quite like that. You know, they need to feel like there's some, you know, what you know, who are you, and not just like your logo, you know. Mm. So
is that down to the kind of well, twofold, the product that they're selling and the demographic that they're trying to target? Because if you take made.com, how many young 20 something Zenellians or whatever they're called, I don't know, well, let's go with millennials.
No, because I'm one of those. I don't associate with that.
A couple of decades younger than me, who've got different...
I'm not a couple of decades younger than you, by the way. Just
you're the one that I can't pronounce.
Millennials.
Thank you. But, you know, what are they interested in buying, and where's their loyalty? So where does the brand affinity come in or not come in, as the case may be? So that's where perhaps part of the disconnect is. And are they, you know, they're the digital natives that are quite accustomed to perhaps buying online, don't need that reassurance that perhaps I would need. Now, I've bought stuff off Wayfair, but I did have a question mark going, how reputable are they? What, you know, where do they get their supplies from? Can I go into a store and check and feel the rug or whatever it is, because you can buy anything on there? But I think that's just my behavior pattern. But I do believe that, you know, I was curious to know a little bit more about the experiential side of the in-store piece that you were talking about, Liz, because the store, as we know it, has changed an awful lot. You know, I think how we shop has changed an awful lot. But is that just going to become cyclical like it has done before, when I remember going to the supermarket every Thursday with my mum and doing the weekly shop? Now it's all convenience. Now you can get whatever supplier can send you something, like you order food online, you can get something from the local supermarket. But the kind of pop-ups that you talked about, Lindsay, how are they measuring the return for that investment that they've got within store is the question, you know, and how is that going to be measured back? Because I think there's still an element of old measurement tools and techniques in a new world that might be feeding into this as well.
Yeah, I mean, measurement is definitely one of those really tricky topics, especially when you think of how much you can measure in digital. And then if you look at like a brand's way of measuring with MMM studies and, you know, and at the moment, that's all we have to measure some of those, you know, longer term, not intangible, but harder to measure, like having a store or, you know, going into, say, John Lewis how you have for me, and maybe again, it's I'm also, you know, not as an Eliel or whatever you want to call them, but...
Oh, you just show off there the way you can get it out straight away.
But, you know, there's a sort of, to your point about, is it, who am I buying from? You kind of know what you're getting, right? And, you know, you think, well, if I have a problem with this, I know that customer service will take care of it. With some of these newer digital brands, you're not 100% sure. But, you know, to your point, the convenience is key. So if you get a good experience, there's no reason not to kind of go back, and that can build its own loyalty. But maybe as well, some of these brands are, you know, it's maybe kind of one-off purchases, or people who don't necessarily have, you know, they might need some furniture for their apartment or something, but they're not going to deck their whole place out from the same place. They want to kind of have that variety. And yeah, I mean, yeah. I think
it's hard to tell, right?
Yeah.
And which, I mean, I'm going to use that to kind of move into the next story, because conveniently it's the next story is from CDM, and it's talking about, the headline is pandemic spending habits settled to new normal after online shopping boom. So this is where they're talking about how consumers have settled into this new normal when it comes to their spending habits, with physical retail making a notable return since the end of lockdown. The latest retail sales monitor report from the British Retail Consortium and KPMG found that total retail sales grew 4.9% compared to February 2020, with in-person sales continuing to climb despite declines in consumer confidence and lower foot traffic due to Storm Eunice. So apologies to global listeners. We were hit with a couple of storms recently on top of all the other lovely things that we have to deal with in life at the moment. But what's also interesting is online sales of non-food items fell by 28.4%. So that's kind of contrasting sharply with the 82.2% rise seen in February 2021. So looking, you know, we take all this into consideration, yet while, you know, they're saying that online sales have decreased from the high seen during the pandemic, consumers' preference for online shopping has not made a complete U-turn. By that, they're saying 4 in every £10 shed online is spent on non-edible products, compared to 3 in 10 prior to COVID. And then on top of that, in-store sales food items declined 7.5% from February 2020. So there's a lot of numbers in there. But what I found also interesting, there was some kind of commenting from Helen Dickinson, who's the chief executive of the BRC. She said that retail has driven 5 years of digital transformation in 24 tumultuous months. Yet these positive findings could soon be tempered by growing cost of living, thanks to the increase in food prices and upcoming rises in national insurance and energy costs set to take effect from next month. So digest all those numbers. Ultimately, sales up and down different areas, but really, the question here, Liz, from me to you is, do you feel, big, simple question for you to answer, is the e-commerce boom over right now?
So, no, I would definitely say not. I would see it as kind of like on a sort of axis of value or experience, say, and value. So, you know, the convenience of being able to purchase many of the things online, like your groceries, you know, that's one piece. But I think people, because of COVID, the two things are very linked. The first part was, you know, that you had people who were dying to spend again. So if we look at February to this year, that's kind of when, you know, we've seen people just want to, people like doing up their houses over COVID and stuff like that, and really, and the convenience of being able to get what you wanted while you were in lockdown. But I think that people do want to get back out there. We're social animals, and, you know, people want to make a decision about where they buy things. So I actually may want to go into a store and touch fabric again, and, you know, sit in a sofa rather than just look at it in a picture or a 360 sort of nice, you know,
augmented reality.
Yeah, type, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's fine when you're stuck inside and you can't go out. But what if you do want to really look at the colour according to your eyes? And so I think people have choice again. But the sort of expenditure boom, I think, is obviously having to be curbed by very real world scenario that we have. I mean, people have been talking about, people understand now, you know, that gas prices have went up nearly seven times, and what that's going to do to their own cost of living, what is it's doing to the supply chain. So, you know, and inflation is something that everyone's thinking about as well. So I think that people are probably having to become a bit more cautious with their spending. But e-commerce, I think Helen is absolutely right. You know, the caliber of experience for e-commerce over the last couple of years was 100% accelerated by needs must. And I think they genuinely did get 5 years worth of transformation in that time span. So the convenience of that, I think, is going to continue. to drive e-commerce. So I it's not dead. It's just about choice.
Okay. And before I come over to you, Lindsay, I'm curious, Liz, on that point, do you think we'll see retailers' digital transformation slow down from now on?
No.
Okay.
Because there's, if you talk about retail specifically, the D2C opportunity is huge for, the, you know, and this is going to seek into the whole talk about first party data and the value that it has when, you know, certainly from a digital aspect, third party cookies will be gone, etc. So we need a new mechanism to stitch things together. Mm-hmm. And if that's going to be first party data, they have a ton of it, right? So it's valuable. So there's no, that's a good business opportunity. So, yeah, I think that's not going to hinder things, you know.
Just the disposable income might give people a chance to breathe, because the demand, when I say people, the retailers working on the transformational piece, because like you said, it's just so much has happened in like 5 years has been delivered in 2 years because of the demand. But now if that demand is slowing down, or you're saying, you know, as human beings, we want to be in store. So we've got a choice. So we're not relying on online, which Lindsay's where I'm going to come to you in terms of, do you feel that these findings prove that there will always be a place for bricks and mortar stores? And in particular, you know, what might be keeping more customers from returning to physical shopping experiences?
I think I've forgotten all the numbers that you said, but I think that if the bell has long tolled, according to many people, for bricks and mortar stores, like there's so many analysts out there that believe it's dead. And if you walk down many high streets, you might well agree with you, like many small towns in the UK, you know, there's a lot of empty shops, a lot of empty stores, a lot of charity shops in their place. However, I think that it's encouraging to see the numbers have gone up, whatever numbers it was you said, have gone up. And I do think, loads of numbers, all the numbers, I do think there will always be a place for bricks and mortar stores. And there's already been innovation in that field anyway, with companies like Appear Here that work with empty shop spaces to allow company like DTC companies or companies that are doing kind of different kind of events or whatever to run pop-ups. There's a lot of exciting stuff happening on the bricks and mortar perspective. And particularly kind of when you're tying that in with kind of shopper marketing statistics and analysis and kind of like looking at footfall, in-store footfall and that kind of thing. There's tons of cool stuff that you can do with that I think will help stores. But unfortunately, for retailers, it's going to become more and more expensive to own a physical store and run a physical store. So when we talked in the last story about DTCs and kind of opening stores like Warby Parker, that cost of running a business, cost of operations, is just going to keep going up. And does that mean that they can justify running a store? I read a story about, I live in Walthamstow, northeast London, for many listeners probably already hear me talk about this all the time. But there's a fabric store in on the high street in Walthamstow that since the pandemic is now taking £20 a week in business. And so companies like that all over the place that just can't survive and they'll just see rising rents the whole time. I'm seeing it everywhere. You walk down, my dad owns a bathroom showroom in Winchester. If anyone's in the Hampshire area and needs a bathroom, I'm going to shout out to old Bath Zone in Winchester.
Sponsorship invoice will be in the post.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Roundtree. But he is starting to see, he's had to battle with his landlord for increasing rents because, you know, they can't afford to keep paying what they're paying. And they're now starting to see, in the past, I would say, couple of weeks, things have got much quieter. And they're thinking there's panic around rising cost of living, rising fuel prices, rising national insurance, everything you said, Anne-Marie, plus concerns around the war in Ukraine and what that means as well. And I think that, you know, him and many shop owners like him are going to start feeling the pinch and start feeling concerns. And that's the kind of, that when we talk about this, we sort of forget about those individual kind of SME shopkeepers as well that kind of, you know, have to tackle rising rents and tackle these kind of things. But I do think bricks and mortar has a place, but it's challenging. But I also think as well, like, I'm shopping in shops more than I was, and I hate physical shopping. It makes me very stressed. And I'm starting to do it more and more. And I think that, you know, a lot of people have now got a kind of hybrid working environment where they're working, you know, partly at home and partly in the office. So their energy isn't being sapped by commuting in every day, and they feel like they've got a better work-life balance. And actually, shopping used to feel like a bit of a chore. I think now people are thinking, I've got time to go and do this. I might pop to the shops and have a browse around for a bit.
And have a coffee outside. Yeah. But I'm do you not think that the challenge is equal to bricks and mortar and e-commerce pure play, you know, as we talked about at the start, in terms of actually turning a profit? Because, you know, as you mentioned around the your local high street, say mine is full of two things that, you know, the charity shops and opticians, which you still can't really do without, you know, to do a proper eye test, you need to be in person. But, you know, the local councils are dying for stores to get back in there. And I think, like, the overall consumer sentiment is affecting it. You know, yes, it's tough to make it, but the, you know, if people aren't spending, I would say that they're not spending generally, whether it's e-com or bricks and mortar. So it's, you know, it's probably more feasible to avoid some of those costs if you're just e-commerce. But if you're not selling anything, you still have your costs.
You've still got a business to run.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not getting money. I agree with you. And I think, you know, speaking from a personal perspective as a consumer, I'm not spending. Like, I'm not spending anywhere near as much as I would have been, could have probably this time last year.
Yeah.
I don't remember my habits from this time last year, but I'm sure it wasn't as kind of as dull as they are right now, where there's literally no money leaving my pocket for anything, apart from having to pay for an expensive tooth replacement, but whatever. But yeah, I do think there's a lot of that. And actually, it doesn't matter what business, what commerce business you run, whether physical or online. Actually, it's going to be a really tough time.
It's going to be a tough time for everybody. Yeah. We're full of doom and gloom, aren't we?
Yeah, aren't we?
I might just try and move us on to the next story then, which is...
Is it more positive?
Well, it is for
it
them.
It depends on who you are. Yeah. This is a story from Marketing Brew about how Walmart made $2.1 billion in advertising last year.
Oh, good for them.
And here's how they did it. No, not really.
No, I could tell you that.
Yeah, okay, brilliant. Yeah.
Okay, over to Liz.
Headlines from the piece. Yeah, so the reported earnings are 2.1 billion, so that's 1.6 billion UK pounds. That's an advertising revenue in 2021, thanks largely to their retail media network, Walmart Connect. Although it may pale in comparison to the retail heavyweights, $152.9 billion Q4 2021 revenue. The results proves advertisers' appetite for consumer purchase data, as well as Walmart's dominance, is still relatively nascent space. Now, we're all pretty aware that retail data has piqued the interest of retailers, who can sell insights into the customer's purchasing habits to help marketers better understand and target their audience. What we started off talking about, where the DTCs were good, because they've got shed loads of data. But there's a couple of things here, right? Because we've got a global audience. I'm keen to kind of understand, how does the retail media scene in general in the US compare to the UK, Europe and other markets? Liz, can you share your thoughts, please?
So let's start with the numbers, because I think...
I purposely left out a load of numbers because poor old Lindsay didn't remember half of them the last time. So I thought...
I'm bad with names, but numbers stick for me. So if you... Right, so 152... I'm going to stay in dollars. 152 billion in revenue... Right, that's the average grocer margin is 2.2. Right. So that's what I think I worked at about, say, 3.3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
2.1 billion with, say, a substantially higher margin is almost, you could say, a 50% increase on their total net margin. That's why they're doing it. Right. So it looks like a tiny number compared to their revenue, but revenue is the vanity number.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So the margin you get from retail media is massive.
Mm.
There is a cost to it, to staff the, you know, to build the architecture, to, you know, do all of that. But there isn't the same cost that, you know, to anything like running a retail grocery business, right? So the US is substantially further ahead when it comes to the sort of digital offering from a tech point of view and a data point of view. So, you know, Amazon have paved the way. Everybody's going, oh my God, you know. And I think Walmart actually said publicly that they want to be in the top 10 ad tech companies in the next whatever number of, I don't know what the time frame was, maybe up to 2025.
So, I mean, that's not far away at all, right?
But, I mean, that's a completely different business to, you know, being the biggest grocer in the US or whatever, yeah. You know. So, and all the others are following suit with Kroger, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just too appealing not to do it. And it's the power play between, say, a CPG and a retailer and a grocer. It's completely different, right? It's like if you want to be in our store, you play by our rules. So they're sort of having to invest quite a lot in these retail propositions. And, you know, that's also compelling for a brand because of the data opportunity, insights on the category or their shoppers that they can put back into planning, you know, the ability to be that much closer to the purchase decision. You know, it's the sort of increasing media owner sort of thing that you get, say, with Amazon, that to do with, say, you know, they're now making TVs. They want to get into advertising through TV. You know, the Fire, all of the media propositions that are creating this weird connected funnel for a brand to think about. It's like you've got all of this sort of above the line media, but then I've got all of this really interesting performance related media as well. And, you know, it's because the data proposition can feed both. It's very compelling. So, yeah. I mean, your question was about the maturity. I mean, I think over in EMEA, the UK is definitely, I would say, quite far ahead. I mean, Tesco have been brilliant with first party data for years, right?
So, but that's because they bought Dunnhumby, right?
Well, I mean, I think a long time ago they understood the value of a loyalty of like the consumer data, yeah. and how much brands want that. That was way before digital was, you know, even when you were still going into a store, you know, and just using your club card, before people were really buying groceries online and, yes. and all of that kind of ballooned. But they're all getting in on it. They're either building their own tech or using other tech. Like Walmart's using the Trade Desk.
And OpenX, I think.
Are they?
Yeah, I mean, think so, yeah. But it's, yeah.
So, you know, but that's like, they're ad tech players, right? So, you know, it's so the same thing is happening over here. And, you know, brands like Carrefour are also getting in on it.
Yeah.
And obviously in Asia, it's a very mature sort of retail e-commerce environment with, you
and
know,
re-commerce as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, they've got live streaming and, you know, where it's influencer meets shopping. You know, so yeah, this is going to explode, I think, and it's in, and COVID has definitely accelerated that. And it's been part of, you know, what Helen from BRC said around the transformation really accelerating through COVID. So I see this being a huge area for everybody, for grocers and for brands over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there that they, you know, Walmart recently launched a DSP to enable advertisers to target their shoppers across the web. Lindsay, what do you think about other retailers in other regions? You know, do you believe that more retailers will pursue a similar strategy to Walmart's? And maybe any idea about kind of what techniques are they using to, you know, accrue data and what kinds could we see in the future?
I think, yes, definitely. I think that the retail media will not slow down. And the examples that Liz just talked about, you know, from what we're seeing from Walmart and many other big US stores like Kroger, like, you know, I can't think of any more than one in my head, but also Tesco, obviously, in this market, and Carrefour in Europe. I think that to succeed in this, you can't skip a beat as a retailer. Like Walmart will still have to be the biggest grocer to ensure that they've got all this data to be able to share with the brands that they're working with. So you will have to still make sure that your core business, because it has to be your core business, because the rest of it won't exist without it, is solid. And, you know, Amazon are, and Liz, you mentioned Amazon, they're a fantastic example of this. But Amazon's retail business is arguably a loss leader for their advertising and fulfillment business. Like the retail side of things, you know, is the prices they charge, you do think, how can you make any money off this? And the answer is they're probably not. But they're making such money off advertising, they can afford to counterbalance that. And Walmart will not probably not be far. You mentioned margins, Liz, and that's fascinating. And it feels like Walmart probably aren't going to be far off that type of model as well. And there'll be other big retailers doing the same, a similar sort of thing. I think that it would be foolish for any retailer that has the capacity and has that first party data not to take advantage of it. And I talked about co-op budget earlier in the first of the first story. This is the data that brands are crying out for from retailers. This is what they've been wanting for years. And there's been many different kind of like individual trials between brands. I used to work on a couple of myself, between brands and retailers, where a brand will give a retailer some money. The retailer will then tell the brand what happened with that money and what the results were. And they share an advertising account and make see what's going on. This is that on the giant scale, obviously Walmart using a trade desk. This is exactly what a brand wants and needs to understand how to make their products better, understand who is buying what. And if Walmart can give that to a brand, that's only going to make it a win-win for everybody, including the consumer.
But surely, if they all start offering this kind of retail data offering, right, where does the point of differentiation come then?
Well, do they need to differentiate, though? Because it's insight from, you know, when we talked about like the type of shopper you are. So if for me, Amazon, for me, 100% to do with convenience.
Yeah.
And I hate myself for it because I'd rather support the high street and just get off my bum and go and get something.
Well, you will be. You'll be walking there as well because you won't be able to put petrol in your car.
Yeah, that's true.
And then
true.
The price of Amazon delivery and the outrageous packaging that they still haven't rectified will become more front of mind.
No, they have.
They do use electric vans now pretty much everywhere, though. So
I don't care. I got some bulbs the other day in a giant box with loads of... I mean, if I had a fire, great, it's some fuel, but... I don't.
No, I know. I know that still winds me up. I mean, at least now they are offering the same day because, you know, if a prolific Amazon orderer, you can bucket everything to one day rather than getting them piecemeal. Yes. But you know, to go back actually to the first piece, you know, the first story with Amazon opening up stores. Interesting. You know, like what do they think they're missing out on? You know, I'd love to have a look at their, you know.
Well, that's your brand recognition, the loyalty and, you know, keep being front of mind. I've not been
I went to one in Southwark, where my brother lives. There's one just opened up next to him, which is the grocery one. Is that Amazon Go? I'm not sure. On Southwark Street.
Which is outrageous when it's right next to Borough Market, which you've got all the local suppliers and all the fresh produce.
They went in to see what it was like and said it was bizarre and they were surprised to see Morrison stuff in there because like, they don't really shop for Amazon, didn't realise that Morrison's had got a tie-in with Amazon Fresh. And they said it was a weird experience. But I went to an Amazon store in Bluewater, which is a shopping centre in Kent. And I expected it to be a situation where I'd go in and they would be able to track that I'm in there and I could pick up what I wanted. And I could then just not have to pay for it and I could leave having paid for it in my account. It's a normal shop. It's like Argos.
Oh,
like
really?
A bunch of all like really random stuff, like a small section of video games, a small section of pet stuff, a small section of God knows what, a small section of books, a small section of toys. And it would give you an Amazon customer price and a normal price. And then you go to a till and pay for it and they go out the back and get it for you. Honestly, I don't understand. I was baffled.
Yeah, no, that sounds it's kind of because the fancy ones that they have opened elsewhere, I've never been in one either, is about that, you know, you go in and you pick up and you leave.
Exactly.
I mean, are we that averse to having some kind of interaction with a human being? I'm personally not.
I don't enjoy that. So
well, I'm going to just
sign for me, frankly.
I want to know what kind of privacy or legislative implications are going to be.
Yes.
Because if I'm walking into shop and my data's there and it's available purely through my phone, because I'm a...
Yep.
Do you have to be an iPhone? No, you can be Android.
No,
just a
absolutely
anybody. Amazon Prime person, user person.
I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it's not just that though. It's like, you know, you being online, and I don't think people understand that their data is obviously anonymized and it's put into different categories. It's not used one-to-one. I think that's the big misnomer people have, you know, and ironically, we've gotten rid of quite a useful way of doing all of that with the third-party cookie. And now everything based on first-party cookie, actually, it's more of a privacy concern than it would have been. So
Still using even more access. I mean, look at the morning brew article, retail brew article, the data, obviously, that Walmart have access to, that they are anonymizing and sharing with brands. It's postcode data, it's address data, it's you know, tons of information about me as a person and all my shopping habits. Like, actually, yes, it's being anonymized and it's being bucketed into a category, a topic style category like the Google thing, but probably on a kind of a more granular scale. Well, actually, if I, as a consumer, understood that Walmart were doing that, and that's just Walmart. Walmart haven't even got a loyalty scheme. What about Tesco with their loyalty card?
Yeah.
Me scanning my Tesco club card each time I go into a supermarket. They know I actually went to, I was in a Tesco store recently and my phone flashed up saying, use your loyalty card here, because it knew I was in store. Now, that's actually very convenient. But me as a working in the industry go, well, that's a bit creepy, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's very odd. Because obviously they're using scary football. Though,
as well, if you think about Walmart in the US in particular, you know, the drugs that they're dispensing from the pharmaceutical side of their chain and the information that they have in the medical records that perhaps they have, or that they, the assumptions that they can make and the personas that they will build around me getting my Advil sent to me every other week or whatever, and, you know, a data breach coming down the line. I don't know, it's quite scary.
Yeah, I mean, you've got the chance of data breach, right? So some nefarious kind of use of the data. But then you've also got the kind of point of, well, you know, you've got all of this. What if, where does it lead to, you know? And I think all of the regulators are so far behind, they're like 2 years behind us in terms of, we should worry about cookies. It's like, no, we've moved on from that, guys. Yeah. And now there's a whole new generation of issues to worry about that you don't even know about yet, you know? So I do think that's going to be a big challenge for brands as well, because they don't want to, you know, if you think of a CPG, they want to sell lots of product. They don't necessarily want to know everything about you. They just want
to know enough to be able to get you to buy it.
Exactly.
Over and over again.
You know, you don't want such fine targeting as well that you never get new to brand. Mm. You know, and it's again this kind of catnip of just because you can doesn't mean you should, you know.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I've got all this data, I should use it. It's like, well, actually, you know, be careful how far you go down that road.
Yeah, that's true. Well, now talking about going down the road, this kind of leads us nicely into the second part of the podcast, where we get to find out more about you, Liz, because this for us is a lovely warm up for you to be on stage at ATS London in June, which is very exciting. But perhaps you can tell us and our listeners what you've been working on and what you perhaps will be working on between now and June when we see you on stage at ATS.
Cool. So, you know, I think the digital transformation and the e-commerce thing has been top of mind for me for a number of years. But for the last three, working within Nestle, you know, understanding what the challenges are from the brand side and, you know, really looking at the opportunity around retail media. They've been the kind of the things that excite me most. So
will I be able to buy Kit Kats DTC?
You absolutely can. You can
giant Kit Kats.
Bulk buy.
Oh, that's good to know, because Ciarán is known as the Kit Kat man around Farringdon.
Everyone loves a Kit Kat. So yeah, I mean, I think I personally think this area is super interesting from the point of view of different kinds of brands outside of CPG. You know, you've got, we talked about, you know, the say consumer electronics or higher ticket items and how all of that is playing out. But I think at AT, you know, it'd be good to talk more about that as an industry, and particularly around what we've touched on with data. Because, you know, if we look at the sort of common thread across these stories, it is about the data opportunity, you know, consumer behavior and habits, and how you know, how we still need to remember the grassroots of what we're trying to do when it comes to brand building and growing our customer base and just not forgetting the fundamentals, basically. Mm. And I think there's a lot more going to happen within digital transformation. I mean, those words have become a little bit tired. It's sort of a bit, sort of over...
Is it being said too much now?
Yeah.
Is there another term?
It's kind of lost its meaning a bit.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. I'm actually hearing data transformation a lot more as well now, because people are talking about it it's not just a kind of business perspective, actually it's understanding our data more. And I feel like that's being used more by people that want to hone in on what they mean by digital transformation.
Yeah, but the data thing, again, is first party data the be all end all?
It shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be. Like, for instance, if you're a CPG, you don't need all this first party data. You're still mass marketing to
people will always buy Kit Kats.
Lots, yeah, and you don't just want one typology. You want, maybe within other categories like pet care, you have a certain specific subcategory of pet owner that you're going after. And, if you deploy a portfolio strategy, you're going to look for different segments that you fit with. But I definitely think that the word data is creating so much kind of fuss and craziness within brands that they're obsessing about it, and they're, need to just remember the fundamentals.
Yeah.
It's big data all over again, isn't it?
Oh,
yeah.
Well, it is big data, but actually little data.
Yes, because it's granularity.
Well, for all the leprechauns out there, no. No, but it is because it's per individual as well.
Yeah.
But they're not doing big data right, though. The big data is the foundation. And then you've got your little data.
Yeah.
I know that's very simplifying it a lot, but
I'm not a data scientist.
So that's actually the opportunity, though, because they're not taking care of the fundamentals of, yes, people talk about connecting ad tech to martech, but what about your logistics when you look at shopper and brand, say on someone like Amazon, what are you trying to sell in real life for your sales team over here?
Mm.
And then your marketing team, why aren't they supporting that? So that disconnect needs to happen, or that disconnect needs to go away. And they need to, that's a huge opportunity as well for brands to have the sales and marketing sit together more. So it's like, data helps there. Say you run out of stock in a certain location, you stop advertising that location.
Yes.
That's smart, right?
Yeah. But, like you said, we're simplifying it, but that either those teams are not operating and working together, or everyone's too bogged down and they're kind of missing the basics.
Yeah.
So how can we bring them back, and how can we use ad tech and martech to support that and help them understand what are the kind of key areas that we should be focusing on or talking about?
I think how the agencies are set up. Mm-hmm. They need, because typically agencies have been very much focused on brand advertising, and then performance agencies have cropped up. But connecting those, they're all doing it, right? Everybody understands this, and they're starting to connect things. And they're also starting to connect, say, within the big holding groups, their creative teams and their data teams. So that convergence is happening. But I would argue that because of COVID, that acceleration has put more pressure on this integration to happen faster. And equally with brands, because, having a lot of brands are saying, okay, well, we have a target of X percent for e-commerce sales, mm-hmm. even in CPG. How do we do that? When you're talking billions in revenue, that's a big responsibility to get right, that you say, okay, well, suddenly we have to work together. So connecting brand and demand is definitely where I want
connecting
to focus
brand
anyway.
And demand. Yeah. You'll see that in a headline soon.
In my accent, though, it's connecting brand and demand, so it doesn't have the same ring to it, I'm afraid. Sorry, guys.
You're right, mine sounds a bit more...
Yours sounds much better than mine.
No, but I think that's a real opportunity, right? And that's personally where I want to focus. I don't know in what form, but I want to, I would like to support whoever whether it's a brand or a retailer to figure that out. I think that's where it's going to get interesting the next few years.
Exciting times. Sadly, we've run out of time now, but I'd really like to thank you for taking time out to come in and talk to us, Liz. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a pleasure on my side too. Thank you.
And Lindsay, as always,
I was here.
Pleasure.
I turned up. It's all you can really ask for, isn't it?
You always turn up. Was it your best effort?
It was average at best.
Well, listen, thanks everybody for listening. That's the Exchange War and Mad Tech podcast. We'll speak to you soon. Bye.